This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's now 16 months since Vladimir Putin launched his full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So much that is consequential, from the state of the world economy to European security, rests on the outcome of that conflict. For several weeks now, the Ukrainians have been counter-attacking Russian forces, and as President Zelensky said on Wednesday, progress has been slow. So as of now, how does the balance of forces in Ukraine look? What are the prospects for Ukrainian advances, and what are the obstacles? Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. With me to analyse the war so far and think about how events might unfold are Michael Clark, Professor of Defence Studies at King's College London and Specialist Advisor to the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy, Mark Galeotti, writer on Russian security affairs and director of the consultancy Mayak Intelligence, Shashank Joshi, defence editor of The Economist, and Karen Van Hippel, director general of the Royal United Services Institute. Mark Galeotti, we're now in the second summer of the war, and before we come on to discuss the current counteroffensive, what do you imagine the military and political objectives of Ukraine and Russia actually are at this point?
Well, of course, even military objectives are ultimately political. I think Ukraine, I mean, obviously, in the long term, it wants to drive all the Russian forces out of occupied territory. But I think, realistically, for this campaign season, its aim is to make sufficient gains, territorial, but also more broadly about degrading the Russians' capacity to continue to fight, that it reassures their Western backers that this is not going to be a forever war. And that hopefully it gives enough of a systemic shock to the Russians that maybe they'll begin, it's a very big maybe they'll begin to reassess the war. And conversely for the Russians, frankly, just staying in the game is a victory for them. I think Putin, his strategy now is not to anticipate any kind of victory on the battlefield, but rather to seek victory on a political battlefield. If he can get the West to start to lose faith, to start to lose unity, to begin to kind of reconsider whether it's worth spending what is, after all, billions of pounds, euros and dollars every month on continuing to bankroll Ukraine, then he thinks he has a chance of forcing an ugly peace on Kyiv. So really, I think he just wants to make sure that he holds the line as far as possible and maintains as much of a toehold in Ukraine as he can.
Karen Van Hippel, is that how you see it as well?
I would agree with Mark. We also know that in a year and a bit will be the U.S. elections and things could change significantly. So there's a lot of pressure on them for those political reasons and military reasons to have as much progress as they can this year, Ukrainians I'm talking about, so that they can ensure Western backers that they're worthy of the support and that they can push back as much as they can before they all go to the table to discuss a ceasefire.
Now, Michael Clark, let's look at, again, before we come to the counteroffensives, what losses both sides have taken in terms of people and material and expenditure in the war so far?
Nobody's giving any official figures yet, but we know that both sides, as will be the case with an offensive, both sides suffer for all of this. Russian figures are not credible. They say that they've taken out, you know, more than 60 or 70 Western tanks, which is simply not credible. But certainly the Ukrainians have lost a couple of Leopard tanks and some Bradley fighting vehicles. And losses in terms of personnel look as if the Russians are running at what looks like they're back to 5,000 or more a month, maybe 8,000 a month. The Ukrainians seem to be back to 2,500 to 3,000 a month, and that will likely increase. Those losses are casualties, not killed in action, but casualties.
Okay, Shashank, as far as we know, what is the position, and again, this is before we come to the counteroffensive, what's become the position with morale on either side?
I think Ukrainian morale remains fairly high, although going on the attack and losing people is always a blow. One of the big advantages of the Western armored vehicles that Ukraine has been given for this offensive is that they protect the crew inside them. That is, the vehicles may be lost, as Michael said, and they have been lost in some cases, but the crew inside are more likely to survive a mine or an attack on a American Bradley than they are on a Soviet-era BMP armored vehicle. So crew survival helps with morale if you know you're going to make it out. On the Russian side, morale, I think, is low, but I would issue a caution that low morale is not enough to cause a disintegration of lines. If you're sitting in well-protected positions, in trenches protected by pillboxes and fortifications, and you have heavy artillery going out against the enemy behind you, backing you up, it can compensate for lots of those morale weaknesses. Whereas, of course, if you're forced in a dynamic situation, if you're forced out of those trenches on the move, then, of course, low morale can cause a disintegration of your cohesion. And that's what the Ukrainians are trying to achieve.
Michael, again, in the bigger picture, what does the balance of military forces currently look like?
At the moment, the Ukrainians are able to mount a broad offensive across the front. So they're mounting a counteroffensive in four particular areas, and they look as if they're going sideways in the sense that they're trying to broaden the field, whereas the Russian forces at the moment are holding their shape quite well in fixed defences. It's a bit like watching a football team or a rugby team. If you look at the defence, you can see although people are running around, they're holding a certain shape. And the Russians are doing that. They're holding their shape in the way they're rotating troops in and out of the front lines, as it were, disposable troops in the front lines, better troops behind to conduct counterattacks and then withdraw again.
Let's now talk about the counteroffensive directly. Mark Galeotti, you've hinted at it, but maybe we should pull out a bit what we think Ukraine's objectives in the counteroffensive actually are.
The very point of the broad offensive that Michael described is, first of all, to keep the Russians guessing. Secondly, to see if they can identify particular weak points, but also thirdly, in the hope of getting the Russians to deploy their reserves. The Russians still do have relatively highly combat-ready forces, particularly of the 58th Army, which haven't really suffered so far. And if the Ukrainians can actually get the Russians to deploy those, it will give them an opportunity to then strike where the Russians are weakest. But I think generally speaking, it looks as if they are likely to be sort of focusing on the south, on the sort of Tokmak communications hub, and then either the city of Melitopol or the other one of Mariupol, with the idea that this would actually allow them to break the so-called land bridge that connects mainland Russia to the Crimean Peninsula. If they could do that, first of all, it puts Crimea in a very, very weak position. You know, it could not necessarily be easily stormed, but it can, in effect, be besieged. But also, it is exactly the kind of spectacular that the Ukrainians would like, precisely to try and dispel the risk of Ukraine fatigue and to demonstrate to Western allies that they are a winning proposition.
Now, Michael Clark, this week, President Zelensky admitted that progress had been slow and then said something to the effect of, well, but you shouldn't have assumed it was going to be quick in the first place. Now, how do you read it?
No, I think that's exactly right. As you said, this is not Hollywood. And rumours in Kyiv, as I understand it, are that he's going to make quite a big statement on the 28th next week, which is Constitution Day, reviewing for the Ukrainian people where they are with the counteroffensive. You know, the point here is that the Ukrainians only look as if they've deployed about three of the corps that they prepared for this offensive, and they seem to have about 12 corps ready and another four or five behind that who could then be mobilized as and when necessary. So they've only employed the first part of their forces, and the big stuff, the really combined arms heavy metal, hasn't really yet engaged.
What have we actually learned in the last few weeks from the battlefield about the way in which a modern warfare like this, and this particular warfare, is conducted? Shashank?
I think we're learning something that we had hints of before this conflict from other wars like Nagorno-Karabakh, which is that the battlefield is increasingly transparent. That is, this ubiquity of sensors in the sky, which is partly drones, there are huge numbers of them, but also satellites and other kinds of sensors, are making it very difficult for ground forces to survive if they concentrate in any one spot and if they don't move very quickly indeed. And the feeling before this conflict was that this may give the advantage to the defending side, because the attacker typically has to concentrate their forces to achieve a numerical advantage, sometimes dubbed 3-1 of a ratio of attackers to defenders, and that makes them very vulnerable when they do that. I think Ukraine is finding that out. Now they are on the attack. It is they who have to get the element of surprise, who have to concentrate without being detected, without being spotted. And what we're seeing is that this battle of reconnaissance, the battle to spot the enemy, the battle to avoid being spotted, is incredibly difficult. We've had a figure from researchers in Rusi Karen's organization telling us that Ukraine is losing around 10,000 drones a month.
Can I jump in on that?
Please, Karen.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think at the macro level, we've learned, we always learn something in every war, and there are always incredible innovations. And the Ukrainians, as we know, have been very creative. They've been receiving so much help from around the world, but they're also getting help from these big tech companies like Palantir. And so despite the attrition and the heavy loss of the drones, they've been incredibly creative in the ways that they've innovated with the use of drones. And I do think that will change. That's just one of those markers for future wars.
Mark Galeotti, there have been these asides. There was the incursion by the Russian dissident brigade into southern Russia. Then there were the drone attacks in Moscow. Are we to see these things essentially as sideshows that don't have any enormous strategic significance, but nevertheless a kind of capture our imaginations?
Oh, no, they're much more than that. I mean, look, I think that this really goes back to understanding this initial point about the fact that all wars are political acts. From the point of view of the Ukrainians, they know that they are fighting a country which, however much its forces have been degraded, and frankly, to a large extent because of the catastrophic initial strategy. But nonetheless, you know, Russia is a country with more than three times the population of Ukraine. If we were just simply looking at a slow, grinding, attritional war, actually Russia could, if not win, but at least do devastating further damage to a country that's already been sort of trashed heavily, especially in the east. So what they are doing is also trying to attack the political basis. So they're trying to basically make Russians, ordinary Russians who up to now have been sort of exposed to most ridiculously toxic propaganda by the Kremlin, to realize that this is not a war that is happening somewhere else, but that actually also can happen on their own doorstep, to undermine the sort of pretentious vainglory of the Kremlin, and also to impose very kind of specific dilemmas. I mean, the incursion into Belgorod, that although Kyiv says, oh, no, it's just these anti-Putin Russians operating autonomously, clearly these are people who are basically run, armed and equipped by Ukrainian military intelligence. That was precisely there to impose a dilemma on the Kremlin. Do you seek to reinforce your own undefended borders by moving troops away from the battle lines? Or do you be ruthlessly pragmatic and essentially let Belgorod fend for itself, and in the process look as if you're both stupid and uncaring towards your own population? The Kremlin, true to form, did the latter. So I think, you know, all of these should be considered not just simply as sideshows. Yes, they're not as dramatic as, you know, a major sort of tank-led offensive or the like. But nonetheless, they are part of the way in which actually Kyiv in particular is proving able and quite ruthlessly efficient in trying to undermine some of the political support for the war at home. Because that will affect things like whether or not Putin launches another wave of mobilization to get extra troops. There is a direct correlation between the political and the military.
And I think we should just explain for those without a map in front of them that Belgorod is a fairly major Russian city close to the Ukrainian border. Now, one thing I'd like to know a bit more about, partially because the briefing room did a programme entirely about the Wagner Group fairly recently, is whether or not the Wagner Group and its leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and we were talking about them in the context of this battle for the town of Bakhmut, which went on a long time, whether that is still an ongoing problem for the Russians, or whether or not essentially he's a busted flush. Shashank, do you have any view on that?
Yes, what happened is there was this extraordinary breakdown in relationship between the Wagner Group and its head, Evgeny Prigozhin, and the Russian Defense Ministry and Russia's regular military leadership. And Prigozhin pulled his forces out of Bakhmut in a flurry of publicity. And Ukraine has managed to take advantage of that because those troops were replaced by a sizable number of regulars who were of a fairly low quality. And I think that's one of the reasons that we have seen this reasonably successful Ukrainian effort on the flanks of Bakhmut, the edges of Bakhmut city, including some high ground around it. They have pushed over there. And we're really seeing these extraordinary public interventions almost daily now from Prigozhin.
Mark?
We focus on the high-profile spat between Prigozhin and Defense Minister Shoigu. But in some ways, I think what we also have to recognize is this is actually just simply a symptom of a wider problem. The whole Putin system was built around constant divide and rule within the elite, ensuring that there are multiple overlapping institutions, individuals with rival briefs, so that they're squabbling and Putin maintains his position as the great decider of their disputes. Now, that's worked to keep Putin in power for 23 years. But what's happened is that's effectively been transplanted to the battlefield. We have Wagner, we have other mercenary groups, and there is no meaningful unitary command. So Putin's system, which is so effective at keeping power in Moscow, has proven also to be deeply dysfunctional on the battlefield.
Michael, let's look specifically at the war. It's a very direct question, really. I was very struck by looking at some recent documentaries about, as it happens, the Allies at the end of the Second World War pushing forward to the Rhine. And I was struck by how even a small defensive force can stymie a large offensive force, even when that force has air superiority. And the Ukrainians don't have air superiority. Can they win the war without air superiority?
They can, but it's very difficult. When you say win, prevail in this counteroffensive is really what we're talking about. The Ukrainians won't get anything close to air superiority until the autumn, probably at the earliest. And we'll see, you know, as and when that happens, what difference it might make. But it also reinforces the fact that they've got a big job in front of them, and it may take a lot longer than Western powers have been led to believe or have convinced themselves it will actually take.
Shashank, why might the Ukrainians get air superiority by the autumn?
Well, they are getting training on American-made F-16 jets, which are very numerous. There's about, I think, nearly 5,000 of them that have been produced since the 1980s. The Americans dragged their feet on allowing this training to occur, but a number of European countries, led by the Netherlands, who have retired their fleet of F-16s in favour of F-35 stealth jets, have said they would be willing to supply them. But the training will take a number of months. It is only really just beginning. And then, of course, they will have to find suitable air bases and so on.
Can I just look at now what other support Ukraine still needs, Michael?
They will need a lot more ammunition. At the moment, the Russians seem to be firing off about 45,000 shells a day. The Ukrainians are firing off less than 10,000 a day, and they will need a lot more. And we're facing a sort of crisis in the autumn in Europe, where the European countries have given all that they reasonably can from their own surplus stocks, and their own stocks are now getting lower. And our defence industries are simply not able to produce the sort of numbers that will then be required.
Mark Galeotti, what do we know about the Russian supply situation?
Well, look, the Russians have moved into sort of basically almost a wartime economy when it comes to their armaments factories. Bit by bit, we're seeing the Russian forces, although they're still profligate in the use of ammunition, but essentially having to become more and more of a rather sort of simple late 20th century rather than proper 21st century army.
Well, that's very interesting because it suggests that there are actually supply problems of different kinds on both sides. And that also takes us to this question which always arises at this point, which is the question of nukes. And it's Vladimir Putin raised it again. We're talking about moving nukes to Belarus. Michael, what do you understand to be the nuclear threat? Has it altered at all since we last discussed it and thought that it actually didn't amount to much?
No, not really. I mean, the rhetoric keeps going up and down. Every now and again, Putin is told by Xi Jinping in China and Modi in India to keep it down, and he stops talking about it for a while, and then he talks it up again. And this is all to try to frighten the West into feeling that this crisis could spin out of control into a third world war. But objectively, we're still back where we were at the very beginning of this, which is that to make any battlefield difference, Putin would have to use several theater nuclear weapons, all of them, something of the order of Hiroshima bombs. I mean, you know, 10 kilotons. Hiroshima was 14 kilotons. So you need a number of 10 kiloton bombs to make any difference. And the effect that would have on world politics, on the attitude of the world towards Putin, the attitude of China towards Russia, would be pretty fundamental. So I don't think objectively, you know, anything is very different there. I worry much more about the idea of a nuclear accident, a Chernobyl-style nuclear accident at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant or at the four other nuclear power plants that Ukraine operates. I mean, that's a more plausible scenario, which would be very bad for everybody.
Karen, I think this is a good point at which to talk about the state of diplomacy. A lot of people will have noticed, for example, the African delegations to Kyiv and to Moscow. How did you read that delegation and the general chances of diplomacy in the field?
I don't think anyone took that delegation very seriously. On the other hand, from the African perspective, they're the ones suffering the most from the spillover of this war in terms of, you know, energy, food shortages, and economic spillover. There are other countries that have been offering or trying to mediate. I know even the Pope has offered to mediate, and I think it would be harder potentially for the Ukrainians to say no to the Pope. But they're just not ready to go to the negotiating table because they're not ready to declare to accept the status quo. But it is interesting how many countries have offered. Brazil, Turkey, I mean, so many countries, Indonesia. And a lot of this reflects the fact that the West has been waking up to the fact that much of the developing world and the non-Western states are actually more in the Russia-China camp than we may have thought before this war started. And that even includes countries in the Middle East. They're all trying to not only balance the relationships between Russia and Ukraine and the West, but many actually do lean much more towards the propaganda version of this conflict that the Russians are espousing, which is that, you know, the West has been imperialist. The West is trying to bring Ukraine into NATO. Ukraine is on Russia's doorstep. The Americans understandably didn't want Russia on its doorstep during the Cuban Missile Crisis, et cetera. And so the Western countries have been losing that battle of the narratives, unfortunately. But I don't think this peace mission, the so-called peace mission, is going to make much of a difference. But it did give Zelensky a chance to try to at least give his version of events to the African leaders. I think Zelensky has focused much more on Western countries for obvious reasons, for economic support, for military support, and perhaps overlooked the developing countries that are not supporting them, and some of the bigger countries, including India.
Do these diplomatic initiatives by countries not of the West amount to anything more than saying to Ukraine, give Russia some of your territory?
Yeah, I don't think they amount to much. I think the only country that actually could make a real difference is China, because I think President Putin, probably the only person he would really listen to is President Xi of China. And so many countries behind the scene are asking China to do more. And Ukrainians are obviously trying to get China to do more and trying to ramp up their conversations with the Chinese. They haven't had enough of them. And don't forget, China, even though it values its relationship with Russia for all sorts of reasons, doesn't like the war in Europe. It's losing its friends in Europe because of its support for Russia. It's losing economic opportunities. And it is also feeling the spillover at the global level that every other country is from this war.
Shashank Joshi.
Remember, of course, that the point of diplomacy with China is not just to get it to do something positive with regard to interceding and pushing Russia towards talks. It's really also about what it doesn't do and getting it to avoid something, which is persuading it not to deliver large-scale arms to Russia. Because if it did that, that would be one of the most consequential changes we could see in this war over the next year.
Mark, as a veteran Russia watcher, do you think that the Chinese going cold, if you like, on Russia's cause would have a significant effect in Moscow?
In and of itself, no. I think Putin is too deeply mired in this war. It's, as far as he's concerned, I think too politically existential for him. If all else fails, if some kind of a peace deal needs to be struck, Moscow would rather it be struck through the good offices of Beijing than looking as if it's been imposed on Russia by the West. So I think that may be China's role in the future.
We're coming to that dreaded moment at the end of the programme when I'm going to ask you all to project. Michael, do you think we'll be having a version of this same conversation at about this time next year?
Yes, under different circumstances, because I think both China and Russia keep saying, and they mean it, that the Ukraine war is the focus of a historical realignment in world politics. And I think they're right. Both China and Russia say that the era of US dominance and the era of Western dominance is now over, and that our influence on the rest of the world is shrinking hugely, and the global South is now realigning itself with alternative power centers. And this Ukrainian war has revealed, as Karen was saying, how unpopular the West is in Africa and even Latin America and large parts of Asia. And so this idea of a historical realignment is real. And the question is, how will we realign in the next few years? And the Ukraine war is one of the fundamental sort of pressure points within which that realignment will take place.
Karen, do you think we will be having this same discussion next year?
Well, the conversation will shift, because I do think by then Ukraine will have made much more progress in trying to get into the EU. They're trying to meet the conditionality. They've made progress on two of the, I think it's five areas or seven areas, but they are making progress in other areas. They're just not quite where they need to be. And as much as they can understand what security guarantees they will get from the West, which will be discussed at the NATO summit in July in Vilnius in Lithuania, as much as the West can guarantee some sort of security for Ukraine after this war, probably short of NATO membership, but even before the war ends, that is also going to bolster Ukraine's position as much more firmly in the Western camp than the Russians would have wanted.
Mark, what do you think?
Sadly, yes. As people have said, it'll be a slightly different conversation, but we'll still be having it. Not least because, look, even if the Ukrainians were able to drive the Russians out of every square inch of Ukrainian territory, which I find difficult to believe they can do in the next year, that does not in and of itself end the war. It simply moves the battle lines to the national borders. Until there is some kind of a peace deal, the war will continue. And I think the problem is absolutely going to be converting military success into some kind of a political process. So this may not always be a hot war, but I think there will be a conflict on the Ukrainian-Russian border for some time to come.
Shashank.
I think that's all correct, but I wouldn't want us to get overly gloomy by looking at all of the Ukrainian weaknesses without also making sure we draw attention to the Russian ones. And I think one of the most important factors in this is that if Russia wants to restore significant offensive potential to be able to take back lots of Ukrainian territory that it will undoubtedly lose in the next few weeks and months, let alone restore control over the four annexed provinces in Ukraine, it will have to mobilize. It will have to conduct fresh waves of formal mobilization running into hundreds of thousands of young Russian men. And that is going to come with political and economic risks that the Kremlin doesn't fully understand and doesn't fully control, which is precisely why it hasn't conducted that second wave of mobilization yet. So there are risks to the Kremlin here in a longer campaign, and don't assume it can just grind this out in the way that it would like us to believe.
Shashank Joshi there with Mark Galliotti, Karen Van Hippel and Michael Clark. My thanks to them, and my conclusion after listening to the experts is that though there is a long, hard road ahead, the initiative in this second summer of the war very much lies with Ukraine. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Bethan Ashmead and Claire Bowes. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Graham Puddyfoot. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. And if you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and listen to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking whether we should worry about the AI revolution, the one about how we fix Britain's railways, and the one on the threat posed by avian flu.
Along with COVID-19 came the rise of the conspiracy theory movement in the UK.
The system's rotten at the core. It should be deleted.
I'm Mariana Spring. In my new series, I'll be exposing how radical some people in the movement have become and how alternative media is fueling them.
So many crazy stories have been spread so far and wide. that it's hard to see this ending well.
Mariana in Conspiracy Land on BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.